This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you're out there across America, why, of course, we always welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast at 464-8295. But I ask that you hold your calls for a few minutes because, in fact, I don't even think we're going to take any calls this hour. We have with us this evening Dr. James Herson, a professor of law at Trinity College. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm fine, Dr. Stan. It's a privilege to be with you again. How are you this evening?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. It's a beautiful, beautiful, cool, invigorating evening. I was just out for a stroll before I have to undertake the marathon here. And this evening we were going to talk about the Constitution. We're going to try to do a couple of programs just to give our listeners an understanding of the amazing Constitution, which was the foundation of our republic, our republican form of government that has been the envy of so many people throughout the world for well over two centuries. Now, much of the foundation of that Constitution is being progressively eroded by those who would alter our way of life, but we still have that Constitution as the framework of our government, and if we can reclaim that, then, of course, we could reinstall this wonderful, wonderful system of limited government that allowed us to have so much liberty and freedom for such a long period of time. So would you like to start with the Constitution, Doctor?
Well, you know, I thought that the first thing we just discuss is this concept of legislative intent, original intent, so that we understand the reason that we're going to look at the Constitution from the historical context and understand what our founding fathers intended and why that's important. And the reason is, of course, that, and this is taught in law schools throughout the nation, that when judges and lawyers interpret statutes, they're taught to interpret it by the intent of the people that drafted the statute. That, of course, is the legislature, and that's called legislative intent. As a matter of fact, there are consulting companies that exist just to determine the legislative intent of a statute. Say if it was very old, they'll go back and look at the records of, say, a state legislature to determine what it was that those legislatures, those lawmakers intended. And that's accepted almost everywhere in terms of interpreting statutes, and was accepted as a maxim when interpreting the Constitution. But unfortunately, that concept seems to have been somewhat abandoned, I shouldn't even say somewhat, by this judicial activism that has departed from looking at the Founding Fathers' intent. And, you know, Judge Robert Bork, who was so highly criticized, he insisted that the only reliable way to interpret the Constitution is to consult the intent of its authors. And when judges don't do that, then they're just free to basically make law instead of interpret law.
In other words, we have rule by man rather than rule by law.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, in my book, In the Coming Collision, I had a little section that I called The Elastic Constitution, where I talked about that, where what's happened is this judicial activism has departed from this notion of original intent. So in our discussion, that's the reason why here on Radio Liberty we're focusing on the original intent. And the two things that help us to focus on that is the historical background and the writings of the Founding Fathers. And there's this amazing set of papers that is probably only slightly less in importance than the Declaration and the Constitution themselves, and that's the Federalist Papers. And so to understand that, I think what we have to do, and we did another show where we talked about the Declaration of Independence. And, of course, after we declared our independence, for the next 7 years, we fought this war with Great Britain, and then we signed a peace treaty in September of 1783. And at this period, the states were pretty much governing themselves. The states would collect their own taxes and enforce their own laws and pay their own debts and negotiated with foreign. They acted as individual governments, and there was a sort of a weak national government set up, or was perceived as weak, in a document that was called the Articles of Confederation. And so this was basically allowed the states to remain sort of as independent, sovereign mini nations, in a sense, doing what they pleased. And they didn't really have to kowtow to a national government. But there were problems with this setup because the states were printing their own money. They were negotiating their own trade agreements. It was slowing down trade from one state to another. And so about 4 years after the Revolutionary War in 1787, delegates got together at this convention in Philadelphia, but their purpose was to revise the Articles of Confederation. But once they got together, they started drawing up a whole new document, and that was the Constitution. And there were two groups, one of which favored a very strong kind of national government, and that group was called the Federalists. And then there was another group which was against this strong national government called the Anti-Federalists. And these two groups debated very heavily, and in basically the Federalists published 85 essays, and they were written by John Jay, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton. And they were basically setting forth the arguments to accept this new Constitution, and those essays that were published over a period of time in an independent journal in New York City became known as the Federalist Papers. And through the discussions between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, we gained great insight as to the meaning of these provisions in the Constitution, the real meaning, not the meaning that judicial activists have distorted it into.
Now, and when did we start getting this judicial activism? Was this in the 60s when they really began just to undermine this whole concept of the Constitution being a permanent document and replace it with this idea of whatever the Supreme Court says the law is, that's the law?
Yeah, I think, well, the 60s it accelerated it, but it was already appearing in the 40s. We saw it, and we'll get into on a future show when we talk about the Bill of Rights, but we really saw the clear kind of undermining and distortion of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, where we saw, you know, religion being just stripped away, religious expression being stripped away from the public square. But we also saw it in other areas that we'll talk about. I don't know if we'll make it on this first show, but but you know, we're a congressional power, and the notion of limited government was really stretched out of proportion, like the Commerce Clause is a good example. And so it even started earlier, depending on the issue. But so it really is so helpful. Well, first of all, the first thing is just looking at the text of the Constitution itself, because it really is written in a brilliant manner for ordinary folks to be able to understand it. And it helps us so much to look at the text. And then the other thing is just to understand through the Federalist Papers and other Founding Father documents what the intent and the meaning of the text really was supposed to be. It's interesting, you know, when we talk about the Federalist Papers, it was like an adversary system in a way, because there were disagreements between these two sides And through that, and I believe it was divinely inspired, what emerged was a number of compromises that helped to form the original union and the original notion of the Constitution. There, like the larger states wanted representation according to their population, while the smaller states wanted each state to have the same representation. So the compromise was creating two bodies of representatives, the Senate and the House. And this is called, there's a fancy word for this, bicameralism. And the two separate bodies, one's based on population and the other's based on statehood. So that was a way of where the two sides kind of compromised with something that turned out to be better than either side's original idea. And they had different economic interests. The southern states were agricultural and dependent on slave labor, and the northern states were more involved in manufacturing. So they had to have a compromise where the federal government could, in fact, regulate commerce and not pass laws against bringing slaves into the country. That was part of the deal. And not tax goods being shipped out of the country, and not make agreements with foreign countries without special approval by the state's representatives. And then, of course, people often wonder why the Constitution, and they use, people try to attack the Constitution because of the slave issue and throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, our children are taught the Constitution was written by racists, and therefore it's no longer a valid document. And in some schools, you know, the Constitution and Declaration of Independence are thrown out the window. But the reality was that the economic situation, the southern states wanted slaves to be counted as part of their population in determining the number of representatives. And the northern states didn't want to count slaves for that purpose because it had to do with the amount of representatives they would have. So they compromised, and the compromise was 3/5 of a state's slaves could count as population for representation purposes. It was a political compromise, and that's where that came from. So, and of course, before the Constitution was written, states had their own state constitutions, which laid out how they would operate. And once the Constitutional Convention reached an agreement, the new Constitution had to be approved by 9 states before it became law, and it had to be ratified. So it was during that period where this debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists took place. Another interesting point is Hamilton contributed to the Federalist Papers. One of the things was how much the U.S. presidency depends upon the character of the president, something that's quite ignored in the Federalist Papers. And that was that's an amazing concept that kind of came through, and is particularly interesting because it's talked about within the comments on the impeachment process that we'll talk about when we get to Article 3 dealing with the courts. And I guess before we get to the preamble, one of the things that is very clear when we look at the body of the Constitution, and we're going to be tonight probably only talking about Article 1, which is the section that establishes Congress and gives them the power to make laws. Article 2 establishes the office of the president, and Article 3 establishes the Supreme Court and judiciary. But when we look at those three articles, what's interesting is that we see this idea of separation of powers. And the founding fathers held a biblical, scriptural view of man. The idea of the fall of man, original sin. We have to have a healthy suspicion about people. We can't vest them with too much power. No branch, no individual. And what's fascinating is in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 34:22. It says, for the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. And a king, a lawmaker, and a judge are the three branches of government. And it's fascinating. I mean, that the separation of powers could be traced back to the Old Testament of the Bible.
And, of course, it was this idea of limiting the power of government, of which led to our liberty. Liberty and limited government, at least at the national level, were synonymous. And I think our founding fathers realized that if we had ever had total government, we would eventually have tyranny. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting things you've commented on is this idea of the election of the senators by the states. They were to represent the states. They were not to represent the people. In fact, isn't one of the great geniuses of our system that it was to be a Republican form of government rather than a democracy, which is being taught in schools today? Isn't there a very significant difference between a republic and a democracy?
Oh, yes, Dr. Stan. It's really a tragedy that we use the term democracy so loosely, because in point of fact, the story is that after the Constitutional Convention, Ben Franklin was leaving and an elderly woman asked him, what have you wrought? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And clearly there's a distinction, because a republic is a government of laws. A republic is based on the idea of limited government, rule by law, the idea that is set forth in the Declaration, that the government is to secure these unalienable rights, and that they derive their power from, meaning government derives its power from the consent of the government through this social contract, this contract called the Constitution. And democracy is nothing of the kind. Democracy is essentially mob rule. And as a matter of fact, one of the first things that any dictatorship always does is have what's called a plebiscite, which is really a referendum, whether it's phony or legitimate, the majority votes the dictator in as president for life, much like what was part of, and it's a little digression, but in Kosovo, the Rambouillet Agreement that started this whole thing had a plebiscite mechanism in it that would have severed off Kosovo, and it was a democracy approach. And that's why that is such a great point, Dr. Stan, and we need so desperately to get the language back to where people understand that distinction between a republic and a democracy.
In fact, we'll get into that when we get into the Federalist Papers. Madison, certainly the 10th of the Federalist Papers, had written against the concept of democracy. Certainly Plato had written almost 2,000 years earlier, over 2,000 years earlier, that democracies just don't work. That was in his Republic. But the tragedy is, as we move towards ever more government today, most Americans have been so brainwashed by the media and by the educational system that they don't understand the foundation of our nation, and it is built in this concept of our being a republic and not a democracy, which was one reason why we had indirect election of our senators, in other words, election of our senators by the states, and why we had selection of our president by an electoral college and not by the people. Everything was done to get a situation to make it increasingly difficult for the people ever to vote themselves into a dictatorship.
No, that's true. Matter of fact, Hamilton, he was on the other extreme. He wanted senators to have lifetime terms, and he wanted the president to have a lifetime term. But through this wonderful adversarial collaboration, really, between the Federalists, and the Federalists didn't all agree, and that was, John Jay and James Madison fighting with the Anti-Federalists, Mason and George Clinton and Patrick Henry and even Thomas Jefferson. They were able to come up with this republic. I guess the first thing, when we talk about limited government, it's so great. The very first words of the Constitution are, we the people. And when I say the Constitution is, in essence, a contract, and sometimes contracts begin with the word the party or the first part, but the contract is, the contracting party is we the people of the United States. And so it's a contract between the people who are implanted with these rights and powers from a divine source and granting this limited power to the government pursuant to this document, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And, you know, obviously we want to comment on that a more perfect union was the group of independent states joined together, and to establish justice with a capital J, to ensure domestic tranquility, which is to keep the domestic affairs calm and to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. And it's very interesting. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. One could make the argument that the Founding Fathers, when you look at this language, our posterity, in the light of the Declaration of Independence, and the Supreme Court back in 1897 said that the Declaration of Independence informs and is the spirit of the Constitution, that they're talking about the unborn, posterity, because of the unalienable rights, the very first one is life. And so when we're talking about future generations, we're talking about the unborn as well, and establish this Constitution, the United States of America. And then following that are these first three articles, which divide the powers, as I talked about, this idea of separation of powers and how important separation of powers is. And it's reflected in the Federalist Papers, numbers 47 to 51, talks about separation of powers, and how we have the legislative branch in Article 1 and the executive in Article 2 and judicial in Article 3. And I think Article 1 is the longest because the Founding Fathers intended the Congress to be the most powerful branch of government. And, of course, today it's clearly not. They've ceded a part of their power to the other branches.
They certainly have, and that's one of our biggest problems, and what we need are people who will go to Washington, D.C., and take the power away from the executive and cede it back to our legislature, because when you have all power in the hands of one man, no matter how altruistic and idealistic and amount of integrity he may be, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, or absolutely everyone, as has been said. But what about when we have a man with the integrity of Bill Clinton in the presidency? This, of course, is a situation that foreshadows a dictatorship.
Yeah, oh, it does. And that's, you know, and I wrote that little book, Government by Decree, about the executive orders, and that relates to the very first sentence of Article 1. Where it says, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. And the key word there, of course, is all. Legislative powers is the lawmaking power. And if all the lawmaking power is herein granted, and those are key words too, because it's only those powers herein granted, meaning limited government. Congress is not supposed to have any other power than those that are enumerated, and that's been called the enumerated powers doctrine. And that's talked about quite clearly in a number of the Federalist Papers, particularly in Federalist Papers 52 to 58 and 59 to 61 that describe the legislative powers. But one of the things is if all legislative power is in the Congress, then no legislative power is in the executive branch. And we should not be seeing the president signing documents that create law with just a stroke of the pen.
You're like, talking about the executive orders.
The executive orders, right. Exactly.
And presidential decision directives. And then, but all legislative powers herein granted, and I think that term herein granted is so important because there are many things which the Congress is not to do. In other words, they are given certain things that they can act on in Section 8 of Article 1. But if they're not given power to act on those things, then they don't have the power to act on it, such as directing education across America. Simply, would you consider that an unconstitutional power that they have simply usurped as a means of bringing education under the control of the federal government?
Yeah, and they have, and it's very consistent with the goals set forth by the old documents of the Communist Party, which talked about doing just that thing.
Point 10 of the Communist Manifesto of
that's right.
Karl Marx's manifesto.
Yeah, but it's this doctrine that was written about by the Founding Fathers called enumerated powers, which is an aspect of limited government that Congress and the government in general only has those powers that are specifically set forth. Now, there's some language that gives a little bit of extra discretion here and there, but nothing like what we've seen our government grow into, which is amazing. And as I mentioned, there's a fancy word called bicameralism, which refers to the fact that the Congress is composed of two houses. And that was similar to the British Parliament, because they had an upper house and a lower house. And in the next section, section 2, it talks about the House of Representatives, how they're elected and how they're elected by eligible and qualified voters within the states. And when the Constitution was written, the different states had different qualifications of who could vote. So the term used in the Constitution for a person who votes is elector, which means a qualified voter. And a common qualification at that time was owning property. And later amendments, like the amendments 13 to 15, changed that, wouldn't deny a citizen the right to vote because of sex, race, failure to pay a tax, or owning property. So we now have voting based on citizenship. But unfortunately, we have those that want to have voting become something that's given to non-citizens. There are professors in the East Coast who say that the illegal aliens' right to vote is the suffrage movement of the 90s, if you can imagine that. And, of course, Bob Dornan lost his seat because of that kind of illegal voting.
And, of course, it is this idea of changing us from a Republican form of government to a democracy, which they know always results in the establishment of a dictatorship, because there really are people who want a dictatorship. They believe in the rule of an elite, and they feel that when we have the dictatorship, it will be the elite who rule.
Yeah, oh, that's absolutely true. And it's part of attacking sovereignty as well, because if you have just a situation where people can walk across the border and have all the privileges of a citizen, then the border has no meaning anymore, and your territory has no meaning, and pretty soon your sovereignty doesn't really exist. So it's another attack on sovereignty, another aspect of globalism in a sense. Section 2 says the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. And it then sets forth the requirements for a representative. They have to be 25 years old and be a citizen for 7 years. And they shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which they shall be chosen. Now, the next paragraph was changed by amendments and the growth of the United States, because it provides that the number of representatives in each state shall be based on the population of that state. And it does talk about the census. And this is an interesting issue. The census was, the first one was taken in 1790. And we've had required census since then, and now the Democrat Party is trying to take away the requirement of actually counting the individuals as set forth in the Constitution. They want to have statistical sampling, which gives them the ability to fudge and make the different districts whatever they want them to be.
I'm going to have to interrupt you here.
Sure.
We'll be back in just 3 minutes with the second half hour of this fascinating program. Well, this is done.